This audio is brought to you by Muslim Central. Please consider donating to help cover our running costs and future projects by visiting www.muslimcentral.com/donate.
Okay, if you want to come take a seat. So, just as we're going to get started, if you want to take a quick minute, if you can turn to the persons next to you, just introduce yourselves. I know everyone doesn't know each other's names. How your day went, and we'll get started in just a minute, inshallah. Birthday? Happy birthday.
Thank you. They surprised me.
That's so sweet. This is not a slice. This is like a chunk of a cake.
I don't know. That's like everyone's saying it's so big, but like in my family, that's like a small cake portion.
How big is your piece?
No, this is for Brother Father. Do you want to give him a bigger one?
Yeah, give him a bigger one. Thank you.
You're welcome.
That's so sweet of you.
You're
Okay, should we get started? Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Bismillah. Bismillah wa alhamdulillah. Wa salatu wa salam ala rasulillah. Wa ala alihi wa sahbihi wa barak wa salam. So we're going to move on to hadith number 7. If people want to move in a little bit, just so as people trickle in, they know they can still come in to pray. That would be helpful, inshallah. But if people want to pull up the hadith, hadith number 7 in the 40 hadith collection. This one's narrated by a companion by the name of Tamim ad-Dari, radiallahu an. It says, the religion is sincerity, adin al-nasiha. So can people open it up? We'll read it in Arabic and in English. Does anybody have it? It's a short hadith. It's much shorter than some of the ones we've been reading as of recent. You got it? Can you read it for us?
The Prophet said, the deen, religion, is nasiha, advice, sincerity. We said to whom? He said, he said, to Allah, His book, His messenger, and to the leaders of the Muslims and their common folk.
Does anybody want to read the Arabic? Yeah, go for it. It's a short hadith. You want to try to memorize it, just as we've been saying the other ones. Tamim ad-Dari radiallahu an, who narrates this hadith, is a little bit unique now in comparison to the other companions who we've heard and read hadith that have been narrated from them in the first six hadith, right? So Umar ibn al-Khattab, Abdullah ibn Umar, Abdullah ibn Mas'ud, Aisha ibn Abi Bakr, Nu'man ibn Bashir. They all have unique stories, and who they are adds perspective to what it is that we can extrapolate and take away from the hadith. Tamim ad-Dari, in his name, we can draw a lot just about who he is. When they call him Abu Ruqayya, this is a nickname he has. He has a daughter by the name of Ruqayya. But one of the more interesting things about him is that he actually becomes Muslim in the ninth year after Hijra. Right? So this is well into the Medinese period of Islam. So last hadith, we talked about Nu'man ibn Bashir, and we said he was one of the first children born in Medina. Do people remember this I'm talking about? Yeah. So there was a long period of time where there was no children born in Medina after the Prophet ﷺ had come into the city. This was something that was used to kind of mock and ridicule the Muslims. Abu Bakr radiallahu anhu, when his grandson is born, they are very joyous to the extent that he's carrying his grandchild, you know, on his shoulders, walking through the streets. Nu'man ibn Bashir, he is born 6 months after this. And we're able to then think out that this young boy is a child. This hadith is being narrated in Medina. And he's in a place where hadith number 6 is talking to us about the heart and the way that the heart governs over the body. And what does it mean that a child is being exposed to teachings like this, as opposed to many of us, when we're given Islam, we're given just the black and white, the do's and don'ts, the mechanics. But Allah's messenger is exposing children to elements of both the outward and the inward. Do you get what I'm saying? So Tamim ad-Dari radiallahu an, he doesn't become Muslim till the ninth year after Hijra. So the Hijra, for us to just kind of familiarize ourselves, is referring to when the Muslims leave from Mecca after 13 years of revelation, and they establish now for themselves the city that becomes Madinatul Munawwara, Madinatul Nabi, the city of the Prophet alayhi salam. And they're in Medina now for 10 years. Revelation is 23 years of revelation. And so in the ninth year after that hijra, right? It's not the same as the hijra we've talked about, where in Mecca a group of Muslims goes to Abyssinia and they find sanctuary in the kingdom of a Christian king. The hijra calendar and the after hijra kind of designation is in reference to the migration from Mecca to Medina. Tamim ad-Dari is also unique in that before he converts to Islam in the ninth year after hijra, he is coming from a Christian background. So you have all of these people that we've talked about who converted to Islam that were coming from various backgrounds. If you come to the Wednesday Sirah class, we talked about Waraka bin Nawfal, who's Khadija radiallahu ta'ala anha's cousin. We've talked about, you know, many of the companions who were Quraysh, and they were coming out of kind of a Quraishi understanding of theology and practice. Tamim Adari is a Christian man. Some people would say he's even a monk or a priest. And his embrace of the religion comes well after the city of Medina has been established. So it's not just at the onset of it. And he has some unique kind of prevailing characteristics and depictions that are given of him. In the total collection of hadith, they say that Tamim Adari narrates 18 hadith. Right? So when we've talked about other hadith transmitters so far, you have some who have transmitted thousands of hadith, some who have transmitted substantially lesser than that. So Tamim Adari, radiallahu anhu, we have 18 hadith that we are hearing from him. But this also makes sense, right? Because he is Muslim in the 9th year after Hijra. And there's only like another year and some change now. The Prophet alayhi salam is still alive. So the amount of time that he's going to spend with him is going to be pretty short. It's not 23 years of revelation, nor is it the entirety of the Prophet's life before he becomes Muslim. But it is a short window that he's actually converted to Islam and that the Prophet is still alive. Does that make sense? He has a lot of different kind of characteristics that he's known for. People say he loves to read Quran, and he was very deeply committed to the Tahajjud prayer. So much so that there was narrations that say that when he missed Tahajjud once, he felt such a state of remorse that he didn't sleep in the night for a year after that. He was just awake, constantly engaging the night as a way to kind of seek his own recompense for missing Tahajjud that time. You know, and he was known to just recite the Quran for long periods of time, again and again and again. But he also added a lot of different unique elements. Under the caliphate of Umar radiallahu an, Tamim Adari started to give like public kind of sessions on advice to people. And Umar was a little bit wary of this. He didn't want people to do this. The idea that he was trying to have people avoid was that as people came to now start teaching and preaching and telling kind of, you know, insights, they live in an actual society. So there's a lot of poets, there's a lot of storytellers, there's others who are there. And Umar radiallahu anhu, he's worried that the nature of things rooted in the precedent set by storytellers is that when somebody starts to tell a story, they just start to add more to it and more to it and more to it. And it starts to move away from what the original actual narrations and traditions were. But Tamim Adari had a unique relationship with Umar because he had a unique relationship with the Prophet alayhi salam. Right? If you've ever been to Medina, how many people have been to Medina before? And you've seen like the original foundation of the Prophet's mosque, what we now call the Rawda, right? From the gardens of the Gardens of Paradise. It shares a wall with the Prophet's home, and the original foundation, you know, is not that long. It's essentially, right? It's a small space. They're praying in Medina. Medina is not modern day New York City. It's Medina 14 centuries ago. And so one of the things that came to be was that the same way our prayers, it's the same prayers, right? We pray Fajr at the same time they prayed Fajr, inshallah, right? We pray Dhuhr and Asr and Maghrib and Isha. It's all the same, cyclical pattern of the sun. What's happening in modern day, in the modern day, that didn't exist 14 centuries ago when you're going into these buildings and spaces? Guys, can you move this way? Yeah. Can you guys tell people as they come in not to block the door? Yeah. No, you can come in, man. Just these guys sitting here. Yeah. Like, what doesn't exist in Mecca and Medina that we have today when you go to the masjids? Like, just think about what it looks like today. We're here right now, right? Think about if we were in the Prophet's mosque at this time of the day, what would be different? lights. There's no lights, right? And they didn't have any lights in the masjid for a long time. Because you're praying Fajr. Some of us were blessed to sit in Medina together just some weeks ago. May Allah accept it from us. And it's remarkable. We'd get people to come and we'd sit outside the masjid until Ishraq time when the sun rises. And you could literally see the sky illuminating from the sunlight. Do you know what I mean? But you go Fajr, Dhuhr, Asr, Maghrib. It's like still some light, do you know? And then Isha, it starts to get dark outside. So as they're maneuvering in the masjid, they're just maneuvering in the dark. Tamim Adari, he's the first person to bring a lantern into the masjid, you know? And there's now like light inside of the mosque. And the Prophet makes like special kind of dua for him in terms of the light that he's literally illuminating the masjid with. But also understanding that the Prophet takes his advice, do you know? He brings the lantern in and they utilize the lantern. It's like an oil lamp in the mosque. And you can imagine just what that does for people in terms of changing experientially what their relationship is to prayer, right? Can you imagine if we were doing this right now and it was just dark? Like, what would the experience be like? There could be some positives and, you know, negatives, but it's just different. Do you see what I mean? And so he has this kind of engagement with the Prophet ﷺ, and Umar knows this, others know it, because how would you not, like, think about it? Do you know? Like, somebody brought pizza to iftar today, and we've been having no pizza since last year, and the first thing to go was the entirety of the pizza. There's two, like, tables right there. This table was in the back. To get to this table, you had to squeeze through the other two tables. And whoever was the first one to get in line, you got a slice of pizza, right? This is what happened, right? You had to go to the back table and then maneuver yourself back through it. Everybody is making special dua for the guy that brought the pizza. Do you know what I mean? So wouldn't everybody likely know at that time after they've been in Medina? Because he took his shahada after the 9th year of Hijrah. Right? 9th year after Hijrah. So that means that for a while these guys were praying in the masjid and there was no lantern in the masjid. Right? So everybody's going to remember the man who brought the light to the masjid. Do you get what I mean? Does that make sense? He's going to stand out in people's heads. It's not like that guy like came and didn't smell right, or, you know, why is this person like this? This man brought the lamp, the oil lantern, to the masjid. You can now see in the dark. Do you get what I mean? So when he is now speaking to Umar and saying we should do a little bit more of kind of teaching people and giving them their insight, he's not thinking about it from the standpoint of like this is some just random person, but this is Tamim Adari. You want to also be able to understand that the content of this hadith is something that's being iterated towards the end of revelation. Just like Noman ibn Bashir is exposed to the words that we talked about in the previous hadith, in al halal abayin wa in al haram abayin, right to the end of the hadith, ala wa inna fil jasadi mudghatan idha salahat salahat jasadu kullu, right till the end. In, you know, the halal is clear, the haram is clear, the end of the hadith, in your jasad, there's a morsel of flesh. If it's good, the entire being will be good. If it's not good, the entire being won't be good. It's your heart, right? They're talking about these things still towards the end of this. This hadith is going to talk about the kind of foundational understanding of this religion. There's scholars of hadith who they attribute this hadith to be one of four hadith that make the foundation of the entire deen. Imam Nawawi, whose hadith collection we're reading, he says this isn't just one fourth of the foundation. He says this is the religion. This is what this religion is about, this hadith. You know this, you understand it, you implement it. This is what, like, this faith is about. So it's a very important hadith. And you want to think, the religion doesn't have a high bar of entry that you got to be up here and know like thousands of things. But you take these foundational narrations and you act upon them, you engage them, you extrapolate meaning from them, and then there's benefit in this. So Tamim Adari, like some of the things we want to know about him amongst many things, he passes away in Palestine, right? May Allah bring ease to the people of Palestine and end the occupation that's taking place there. He's in a place where he has like a certain reputation amongst the companions, clearly, and he converts towards the end of revelation from Christianity. Nobody's in a place where they're like, who is this man? He just became Muslim a week ago. Like, who is he to tell us to put lamps in our masjid and this kind of stuff? Do you know? But they have a certain sense of mutual respect and understanding and care. And you also think about his commitment to the religion. He gets into it and he loves Quran. He loves prayer. He's coming out of a Christian theology, so the bridge is a little bit different than a polytheistic theology. Like, he's still a real person at the end of the day. He exists historically. And so you want to, like, think about how somebody who becomes Muslim and comes from this now, not sociologically, but has embraced the religion in its essence and then has already reflected on who is God to me. Like, who am I worshiping? These kinds of things. And how, where they come from is not something that's just a departure that they run away, but they're building upon something because they have understandings, and then gaps are filled through the religion of Islam, that certain things just like click and make sense that might not have made sense before. He gets to a point too, then after the caliphate of Umar, under the Khalifa Uthman ibn Affan radiallahu anhu, he now starts teaching publicly like twice a week, you know, and people start coming and convening and gathering and kind of engaging in these ways. There's other like hadith that are more kind of prominently attributed to Tamim Adari, but this one is pretty unique in that it's in this hadith collection and it's quite often engaged, you know, in a variety of settings. And muhaddithin of the past have said, like, this is it. Like, you know this one. This is what your deen is based upon. So I want you to take a minute before we delve into it and kind of break it down. It's because I've been talking a lot. If you can turn to the persons next to you, pull it up on your phone if you haven't already, right? Hadith number 7, Adinu Nasiha. قلنا لمن قال لله ولكتابه ولرسوله ولأمة المسلمين وعامتهم is the hadith. Why just reading it as what it says and just what's in front of you, why do they say, like some of them, this is like one of the four that make the foundations of this religion? And Imam Nawawi himself, he says, this is it. This is what the religion is built upon. You can take a minute, just turn to the person next to you. Like, what comes up for you? What is it that you think you can kind of extrapolate? Why would they say this is like what this is built upon? If you don't know the names of the person sitting next to you, share some names, exchange your names. And then let's delve into this. Like, why such an emphasis on this particular hadith? Because we've already looked at 6. Even if you haven't been here, like for all 6 of them, right? You just flip through the ones that came before. Why not any of those? You know, why is this one so kind of, what's in this that makes it so important? So let's turn to each other and discuss, and then we'll come back and then we'll get into it. But go ahead. Thank you.
I'm looking at like the order at which he said this is after his book, his messenger, and the leaders of the
I think it's sort of like descending order,
not necessarily like literally descending.
I honestly think this is important.
Okay.
It's not a messenger.
Okay, so why do we think this hadith is so important? Like, why are they saying that this is the foundation of all of it? What did we discuss? Any thoughts?
I think it's so I think it's based on the word sincerity is the main focus here. And when I think about the word sincerity, as I was sharing with others, is the concept behind intention and how you really, I guess, accept being sincere with Allah, being sincere with your values and your core beliefs. And if you're sincere in that, you are effectively like strengthening your belief in your iman, like your deen, right? So that's the way that I see the word sincere in this case.
Okay, great. Other thoughts? Yeah.
One of the things we said is, like, also given, like, the context of the hadith, like, and when it was, said, like, there's already foundation in the religion enough for there to be movement to one city to another and, like, still be secure in the fact that Mecca will remain Muslim. And it's kind of like, you already have the foundations, you have the book, you have a good, like, you know, following, and it's like, why are you going to go from that? And I think, like the brother said, like using really baseline of like being sincere in everything you do and where you're gonna, how you're gonna use the book and how you're gonna use the teachings, like in your life. And also we're talking about like within our community and like with other people. Like we were saying, like one thing of like peers can ask, like, you know, how, like, do you know how religious this person is, if they're like talking about someone, and like how to like refrain from engaging in those conversations, because that's not something that's like for you to say. It's between that person and God, and like just being sincere in all your actions, and like how, yeah, like, well, that's an example of how we like framed it into like our like everyday life.
Great. Other thoughts? Yeah.
Sincerity to your creator, to the book, to the messenger, to the leaders. In other words, the goal is, it's the prophetic mission summarized, is you're trying to pull people to a specific way of life, the one the creator has basically instructed us to follow. And so calling people to that, whatever the circumstances may be, whatever resistance you may find, is proof of sincerity.
Great. Any other thoughts? You want to keep all of this in your head as we go through it, right? In the framing of these things. Because the way that we kind of engage can't just be from the standpoint of kind of absorption. You want to contemplate, you want to reflect. Like, if this is something important, how does it then define and actualize in terms of the way that I implement it? What is it really calling me towards? And so hold all of those conversations as we proceed. One of the things we take from this right off the bat is just how remarkable the Prophet's speech is, right? Here you see evidence of the way that he describes, alayhi salam, his speech as being very concise and deep at the same time. So you have just two words, ad-deen and an-nasiha, but it's in this construct that we find in a lot of different hadith. So there's a hadith, for example, that says, Al-Hajju Arafah, Hajj is Arafah. Do you know what I mean? Right? We, like years ago, used to have a tagline in Ramadan that said, Ramadan in New York City is Ramadan at the IC. You know, that's just what it said, right? I don't know why we stopped using it, but it said Ramadan in NYC is Ramadan at DIC. Does that mean that the only place in New York that Ramadan happens is at the Islamic Center? No, right? Yes, it does. Yeah, it's the only place that happens. No, clearly not, right? Al-Hajj Arafah doesn't mean that Hajj is only Arafah. There's other things that go into Hajj, the pilgrimage to Mecca, right? So the deen is nasiha, doesn't mean that there's an equal sign that has reciprocity in that way, that it's only this thing, but it's saying that this is like a big part of this deen. The same way Arafah is a big part. Arafah, the day of Arafah, the ninth of Dhul Hijjah, that is a day that Muslims are recommended to fast around the world. The ones that are on the Hajj pilgrimage, they stand at a plain called the Plain of Arafah. It's one of the integral parts of the Hajj itself, the standing in Arafah, right? And so if you don't have it, you don't have Hajj, do you know? But at Hajj, there's also like sleeping in Muzdalifah. There's still tawaf. You walk around the Kaaba, you know, there's nahar. You are doing like the ritual slaughter of the animal and the like, there's so much more that goes into Hajj. The idea is to just show the importance of this thing, right? And stylistically, it's really, really remarkable that you don't need a lot of words. It's not unnecessarily verbose. It's not wordy. The Prophet takes two words and gives you something that anybody can carry forth with them, right? Because it's meant to be a religion that people of any background can find meaning through, right? It's a final testament, so it can't be unnecessarily complex the way that we make it complicated. Does that make sense, right? The word nasiha, we've probably heard in different settings. If you've been Muslim for a while, usually in this concept of like giving advice to someone, do you know? But here, the translations give us an understanding of sincerity. When we talk about sincerity in many circles, we use the word ikhlas, right? Like the chapter in the Quran, Qul huwa Allahu ahad, is called Surat al-Ikhlas, the chapter of sincerity. So nasiha is not the same word as ikhlas. So how does this get translated to sincerity? One of the things you want to start getting comfortable with is that not knowing how to speak Arabic doesn't mean you can't understand Arabic. And that's just something you have to be able to embrace. There's tons of Arabic English dictionaries. It might be like hard to do, but every Arabic word is usually built off of three root letters. This one is Nun Sad Ha, right? Nasaha. So you open up an Arabic English dictionary and you just look up the root letters and you see all the different words that are built off of this root. There's some roots that are two letters, some that are four, but most are three. If you Google on your phone right now, Surah Tahrim, T-H-R-I-M, and look at the eighth verse of Surah Tahrim, it's going to have this word in it, its derivation. Does anybody have it in front of them? Surah Tahrim is the 66th chapter of the Quran. So chapter 66, verse 8. And you want to start making mental notes of these things, do you know? Because you can also turn to text to understand text. You see, like you don't want to look at things in isolation, but how they apply across kind of various disciplines. So the 66th chapter, the 8th verse, does anybody have it? Just the first part of the first verse. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah. Great. So What are the letters in this word? Nasuhan. It's the same letters as nasiha. Nasuhan, here, if you read the English translation, it says what? What does it say on your phone?
It says, O believers, turn to Allah in sincere repentance.
Great. Tawbah means like turning back to Allah. So, nasuhan is qualifying tawbah. When you think about it in this way, like the utilization of this root, nasaha, is like what they say when you're trying to kind of purify honey, you know, remove from it like anything that shouldn't be in there. So this is where it's sincere and it's repentance. The way like honey becomes kind of clean and pure, you want your turning back to God to be clean and pure, you know? Like, I'm not still pulled by what it was that took me away from God. You remember last week we were talking in the Ramadan class about taqwa. Taqwa is like consciousness, awareness. So tawbah is a spiritual act. It's what, if you fall into the hole, you then are in a place where you have this to get out of the hole. Tawbah is what brings you out of the hole when you fall into it. And taqwa is the thing that tells you, hey, the hole is coming. Don't fall in the hole, you know? So to have tawbatan nasuha is, I'm like real in my turning back to God. Do you see? It doesn't mean I'm not going to slip and fall again. But the whole idea is in that moment, I'm just being as genuine as possible. This is what nasiha means here. Does it make sense? There's another verse in Surah At-Tawbah, verse number 91, if you pull that up. Sorry, I don't know the numbers of all the surahs, but I should probably... Surah Tawbah is chapter 9, verse 91. Can somebody read that verse?
I can do it again.
Yeah, go for it.
ولا على المرضى ولا على الذين لا يجدون ما ينفقون حرج إذا نصحوا لله ورسوله ما على المحسنين من سبيل والله غفور رحيم.
Great. And how is it translated and what you're reading from?
There is no blame on the weak, the sick, or those lacking the means if they stay behind, as long as they are true to Allah and His Messenger. There is no blame on the good doers, and Allah is all-forgiving, most merciful.
Right, so nasahu here is to Allah. You're not giving advice to Allah, you know? So here, it's giving an indication that you have like a genuineness with Allah, you're true to Allah. You understand? And you start to nuance the meaning of the word to be able to then understand its application back. Nasaha also gives an idea that when things are like ripped apart, they're in pieces, the process through which you bring them back together, like if you're knitting something. Do you know what I mean? You're using a derivation of this. And you can look in Surat al-Yusuf, it's utilized again, just in the interest of time. But go to the Qur'an and like see, where does it talk about words in this way also? So that I'm not stuck in a place where my limitation is something that's actually not beyond my capacity. You and I have in front of us a remarkable piece of communication that is the speech of the Prophet of God, sallallahu alaihi wasallam. We haven't even gotten past the first two words, and we've been talking about it for the last 50 minutes. Do you know? And that's not an exaggeration. In being able to just go into it deeper and deeper, you have to embrace, as you're reading hadith, you're reading Quran, which are kind of orated experiences, that one of the things that makes us distinct outwardly and inwardly from the rest of creation, outwardly, you're not the same as other parts of creation because you have the ability to express differently, right? A dog just barks. You don't just make one noise. Do you know what I mean? Right? Like, and it's not variants of intonations of that noise. You have the capacity to put sound together to be able to communicate effectively. And the way you and I understand things, the meanings of things, is through the names of things. وَعَلَّمَ آدَمَ الْأَسْمَاءَ كُلَّهَا. That in the second chapter of the Quran, in the Adamic narrative of creation, one of the things that is said, that Adam was taught the names of everything. That's how you understand things. So when you get to a word, don't just take it at like its face value. And Tamim Adari is interesting here as a character because he's Christian converting to Islam in the 9th year after Hijra. If you've ever had a conversation with somebody who's not Muslim or who's new to Islam, they still exist where language is based off of their socialization. So if I'm talking to somebody of a different religion and I say God, we don't have the same essential understanding of who God is. The word is the same, but the meaning is different, right? A prophet in Islam is very different from a prophet in the Judeo-Christian narrations. And you're not mocking anybody's belief. This is Quran. In Surah Al-An'am, Allah tells you, don't mock people for their beliefs. Do you know? But you're in a place where the understanding here is that if you get stuck, and the only ways that you've heard, Khalid's there if you want to just tell him what's going on. The only ways that you get stuck are, I hear this word nasiha again and again and again in the prism of advice, 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 of counsel, counsel, counsel. I'm not going to get to the depths of what this narration is talking about. Do you get what I mean? And we can expand on it by just looking at it purely from a language standpoint. And then it also helps us to connect to Quran a little bit differently. Do you know? And like these concepts and these kinds of things. We talked about two different verses right now. Like, go and reflect on them and think about them in the context of this hadith. What is the relationship now between nasiha, advice, and like everything that we're talking about here? Sincerity, kind of healing, bringing something back to its kind of holistic form. Do you get what I mean? Like, how does this relate to the concept of advice? And if people aren't familiar with it, quite often when you talk about giving counsel or advice to someone, one of the words in Arabic that's used and in languages that have cognates, Hindi, Urdu, etc., is this word nasiha, right? Like advice. What are we then understanding of advice, like through its relationship from a language standpoint to the way that we're saying this? Does that make sense, right? So how does the word advice stem from like this root? That the Quran, when it talks about tawbah, it says to have a tawbah that's nasuhan, that has this root, right? When it's talking about your relationship to the divine, it's speaking about it in this way that this is a mechanism of being true to God. Do you see what I mean? How does advice fit into this? If you could turn to the person next to you and just kind of break that down a bit, what is it? What do you think? And then we'll come back and discuss. And we'll go into more of the hadith, but go ahead.
Huh?
How does advice, nasiha, relate to like what we're talking about here in terms of this kind of root, nasaha, right? Purity, kind of sincerity, you know, these types of things. Okay, so what do we think? How does advice attach to this concept? What are we discussing? Who wants to start? How does advice play into this concept? Sincerity? Why is it the same word, like the same root letters? Yeah. Okay, great. Other thoughts? Yeah.
We talked about kind of from the other perspective as well, the person receiving the advice, being sincere as well, and I guess kind of the mutuality there. So for that person receiving the advice, for example, we talked about that ability to kind of take and accept and hear the truth from like wherever it comes from, and that being kind of a match to the person who's coming and sincerely wants to share something that's beneficial. Both of those people kind of coming from a place of, I know that I'm flawed, I know the other person is flawed, and I know that we both still have things we can share with each other and learn from each other.
Yeah.
Well, Brother Zacharias said was very similar to what we discussed, but I kind of now I'm thinking of something different. So it's kind of on the fly, but you could see advice as a form of sincerity in the sense that when you're it's much easier to be a yes man, or it's much easier to like not point out a mistake or something that someone has to do better. So giving advice is a form of sincerity in the sense that you are giving your actual feelings on a certain subject with the intention of aiding that other person. Because you might think, oh, this person is going to get upset at me, so it's better for me not to tell them what's better for them. But in reality, you're hurting both yourself and them. Because you're weighing down on yourself and that your I guess vision of them in the sense of like, oh, this person's a wrongdoer, so that's negative for yourself. It's also negative for the other person because they're doing something that may be wrong. They're not having someone sincerely correct them. So
yeah. So if I started to think out like, how do I know, like I'm good with why I'm giving advice to somebody? This is why you gotta look at all these hadith all together. Hadith number one, إِنَّمَا الْعَمَالُ بِالنِّيَاتِ. Actions are because of their intentions. Do you know? So if I have some metrics of assessment that I can start to apply to this concept of giving advice, receiving advice, so they go in both directions, those are two things that have to be present. Like if somebody is going to be good at giving advice in this sense that it would be called nasiha, they got to be ready to take some advice too. Do you know what I mean? And if somebody's just throwing words at us, or I'm just throwing words at someone, I'm not really talking to them, then that's a problem. This religion is really hard to get deeply involved in if you're not open to kind of taking feedback, as well as if the giving of feedback just doesn't really have mindfulness and awareness to it. It's got to have elements of like real love and compassion, real understanding. There's a hadith where a man converts to Islam and he asks the Prophet to teach him something. And the Prophet tells him, someone sneezes, you say, Irhamakullah. And that's a right they have over you. They stand to pray. And in the course of the prayer, somebody sneezes. This man learned that when that happens, you say, Irhamakullah. And so he says, Yarhamakullah, out loud. This is a companion of the Prophet of God. People start to stare at him. And he gets upset and speaks out loud again. Why are you looking at me? And the hadith says they start to hit the inner parts of their thighs to get him to stop. And he gets it, but he's upset. At the end of the prayer, the man says, the Prophet ﷺ comes and speaks to him. He says, I swear to God, Muhammad is the best of teachers. He did not scold me or repudiate me or revile me. He simply said that in the course of this prayer of ours, we're reciting the words of God. It's not appropriate to mix them with other words. Both people got him to understand you don't talk in your prayer. One group made him feel like he had no relationship with Allah. The Prophet made him feel that he still was able to have a relationship with Allah. Do you see the difference, right? So it's not just about like, hey, I want to jump to give advice and counsel. Other assumptions here that you don't want to have is that you know every opinion on everything. That's why the hadith that comes before this is important to think about in relation to this hadith, right? In al-halal abayin wa in al-haram abayin. Indeed, the permissible is clear and the impermissible is clear. And then how does it continue? And between these things, there are like ambiguous things. They're not as clear, right? Bayin means it's unambiguous. It's just clear. Marriage, halal. Fornication, haram, right? This is it. That's what it is, you know? Giving gifts, halal. Stealing, haram. Like, there's not, it's just what it is, you know? But then there's stuff in between. And so here now, you want to even think about this, right? Like, am I in a place where I know enough to be able to comment on why somebody might be doing what it is that they're doing? And if I don't have a sense of love, admiration, compassion, affection, is what I'm contributing going to be helpful or is it going to be worse? Is it going to be detrimental? That's very different from this kind of overt knee-jerk reaction of who are you to tell me what it is that I am doing is wrong is not wrong, you know? Contemporarily, we run into an issue that the way we get in people's business is not really on the matters that we need to, right? Most of you in this room, I work with a lot of survivors of abuse, may Allah grant them ease, probably know someone who is a survivor of abuse, if not you yourself, and I'm not trying to be triggering, but Allah grant you the healing that you're looking for. How many Muslims do you know that get into people's faces about, I can't believe you're talking to the opposite gender, I can't believe that you listen to this thing. And then they're silent when they know that there's somebody who's praying next to them who hits his wife. Right? But just think about it in the concept of what we're talking about here. Do you get what I mean? And where does that flip come in? You don't want to trivialize this beautiful deen. and turn it into something that's just about externals, but also to be able to think out, why is it hard for me to take advice? Why am I like so excited to always give advice? You know, like, why do I want to always tell people that what they're doing is just messed up? Because how you see people isn't just telling you about who they are. How you see people tells you a lot about yourself. And where in the hadith do you see the Prophet just knocking on people's doors? Hey man, you're so messed up and I can't believe you did this. And I'm the Prophet of God, so I know what I'm talking about. You know? No, there's kindness there. There's gentleness there. There's compassion there. And these are other ways to convey like advice. Do you know? But here, when you get to a place of spiritual growth as a metric, right? You want to assess yourself. You don't have to stand and like give rise to the ego, because arrogance is really bad. May Allah protect us from it. Hadith says like a lot about who enters paradise, who doesn't enter paradise. There's hadith that say if you have even a mustard seed worth of arrogance in your heart, you're not going into Jannah, right? Because Jannah is the epitome of purity. It doesn't tolerate what is impure. So if you have a habit of being condescending or looking down, or like a big indicator of arrogance, you don't know how to say sorry for things. And that doesn't go just to peer to peer or somebody who's above you in power. You got kids and you've never apologized to your kids? Doesn't make any sense. You're married to someone, you've never apologized to them? How is it fundamentally possible? You can be in space with people for so long and you've never done anything like that's a mistake to them, right? Like what is going on there other than like what's inside of me that makes it difficult for me to express these things? Do you see what I mean? We're going to pray Isha in like 5 minutes. Yeah? Sorry, not to, you know, yeah. He's my friend, so I can give him advice, right? We just ate lunch the other day together. But in being able to understand this, if we want to see people who are at a high level of spiritual growth, inwardly their hearts are like where they want to be, even when someone's a jerk to them, they're going to say, if there's benefit in what they're saying in some portion, I want to still hear what they're saying. Even if they spoke to me terribly, even if they spoke to me poorly, they're disrespectful. The notion through which they exist in terms of inward balance and character still remedies the idea that you don't become someone's doormat. That's not what we're saying. But can I still extrapolate something from this that I need to hear in terms of advice and counsel? Do you see what I mean? Right? It can sting a little bit, especially when it's true. Do you know? But it doesn't mean that we don't have to hear it necessarily. So the balance has to kind of exist. Somebody says to you, hey man, you probably shouldn't be doing this. And then your response is, well, you do this, right? That still doesn't mean that you don't do what they told you that you shouldn't be doing. You know? And that's where the ego gets involved. That I just have to be right. It's not even about the discussion. And this is where there has to be elements of just softness, kindness, compassion, embedded in some of these things. Ad-deenu nasiha, the deen is nasiha. Like that's just what it is. How can you have spiritual growth if there's nothing to improve upon? Like how? How will you move forward if there's nowhere else to go? Like if you've already reached it, great. Then what's the rest of your life for? Do you get what I mean? Right? So who in your life are those people? And where are you in relation to some of the people that you have to be able to give this type of advice and counsel to also? And so here, you're going to give nasiha to someone. Make sure you have like a certain love for them that exceeds the love you have for you. Because there's this subtle line that I'm elevating myself by denigrating somebody else. I get a kick out of being able to put people in a place where I'm just throwing information at them, you know? Versus, I just really want what's best for this person. And then, if that's genuine, you understand that communication is not just about the words you use. Statistically, 7% of the impact comes from the words. 93% is non-verbalized aspects. Tone, like volume, all this kind of stuff. The packaging of something. Do you know? If I sat here and said all of this that I just said to you, for the last hour or so, and you guys said to me what you said to me, and all of that's great. What if I said it to you just wearing like a pair of short shorts and a tank top, right? You'd receive it differently. Don't play like you wouldn't. You definitely would. You know, if I just had a piece of cake that I finished not for any reason other than last week at the Ramadan class, I told people, don't eat sugary stuff. And I can't have them see me eating cake now, right? But it's somebody's birthday and they gave me a piece of cake and I don't want to not, you know, take from them. This cake was given to me on a plate, right? Clearly, it was pretty good. All that's left is these crumbs. Do you know, right? What if all of this stayed true, but instead of serving it to me on a plate, they opened up a box, took out an unworn brand new pair of shoes and put it on top of the shoe and said, eat it. The shoe's not even dirty, but already the packaging of it is going to have a different impact. This is sensational transference, right? I'm gonna cook you a big steak, but I'm gonna serve it to you on the lid of a garbage can. Even if it's not dirty, your mind's gonna already not want to receive it. Do you get what I mean? I was speaking at a conference. There's literally like 30,000 people in the audience. No joke. I get off the stage and my mom is standing there with me. And some guy got on the stage after me and said one part, like verbatim what I just said. It's not even exaggeration. He said the same thing. My mom was like, Khalid, mashallah, he's so smart. And I was like, mom, I just said that. And she was like, no, stupid, you didn't say that, right? I'm gonna always be her youngest son. Do you get what I mean? It's not just about the words. So if there's real sincerity, do I have to be the one to say it? Or does it need to be said, but maybe not by me? Do you get what I mean? That if there's real love, I can sit down with you and say, hey man, so-and-so is not doing so well, but I'm not in a place where I'm avoiding or deflecting. They just really don't like me. I know how I'm perceived by them, but we gotta still make sure that they're doing okay. Do you get what I mean? My mom, she's not gonna hear what I have to say. Can you go talk to her, you know? Do you get what I'm saying? Does that make sense? So much of this religion is rooted in understanding the importance of language, words, communication. Every single day you're talking to people, both through expressed verbiage, as well as from your body language, your tone, your silence, your quietness. So it's not just, I didn't mean to say that. In the hadith, you don't really see the Prophet saying this, right? Does he have a subsequent hadith that says, sorry, that's not what I meant? Or they just understand him. So you delve into hadith like this to see what the masterpiece of like communication is. And then to just think and understand, like, how do I better express myself? If you've ever met somebody who's an artist, poet, a rapper, musician, whatever, they got little notebooks that they're constantly writing in. Do you know? You come to gatherings like this without a notebook, you're missing out on the opportunity to accelerate your expression skills. If you don't carry a little notebook in your pocket where you just write down things that stick out to you, you don't sit down and have a relationship with language, right? You want to read books, not just because books are good to read, for the importance of knowledge acquisition, ideas, opinions, vantage points, but it increases your vocabulary also. Do you know? Because what if the only word you know is sad? Then what happens when you feel grief, or you feel anguish, or you feel depression, but all you can say is, I'm sad? And then you try to solve for sadness when you really have to deal with grief. But you don't know the word grief. It's not part of your lexicon. Why? Do you get what I mean? You read this hadith and you're reading the word nasiha through what you know the word nasiha means, but not what it means in its entirety. And when you can nuance it and understand it from its kind of depth of a word, it just opens up what the hadith means on a whole. Right? Do you get what I mean? So I go and read the Quran. I open up Surah Tahrim. It has like this word, Tawbatan Nasuhan. What does this mean then? If I only think that this is about giving advice and in this like kind of standoffish way, you were doing something wrong, I gotta just tell you that you were doing something wrong. No, man, like that's not how it works. But there's a lot more that kind of gets embedded into it. Do you get what I mean? As we apply this to the remainder of the hadith, you're gonna see within these categories, right? The companions ask now, قُلْنَا لِمَنْ? Because they don't say first, what is that, O Messenger of God? Right? He didn't say, أَدِينُ النَّصِيحَ, and then they say, what is nasiha? But their first question is, who is it towards? And I want you to think about that between this week and next week, right? Because there's other hadith where the Prophet says things and they ask, you know, the Prophet says, they ask, Ya Rasulullah, ayu nasi afdal, which man is the best, which human is the best? And the Prophet responds with a generic, not a specific. He doesn't say Moses or Joseph, peace be upon them both. He says, Qulul makhmum al qulub suduq al lisan, each one that has a heart that's makhmum and a tongue that's trustworthy. And the companions say, Ya Rasulullah, suduq al lisan na'rifuhu fama makhmum al qulub. We know what a trustworthy tongue is. What is a heart that is makhmum? So the next thing you can understand from this hadith before we even talk about Allah and His book and messengers and the leaders and the common people, they already know what nasiha is, right? They're in the 9th year after Hijra at least, because this is when this man becomes Muslim, Tamim ad-Dari, who's narrating the hadith. So they don't have to ask what nasiha is. They're not in a place where nasiha is a weapon that is just breaking people down. They understand it through love, mutual responsibility, care, affection, kindness towards one another. So the Prophet says, "Adinu nasiha," and the first question they say is, who do we give it to? Who is it for, O Messenger of God? And then you have these broader categories that have particulars that we'll discuss next week that pretty much make up how you relate to everything. How do you relate to God? How do you relate to God's book? How do you relate to God's messenger? And how do you relate to God's creation? What else is left? Right? And then it serves as the foundation of the deen, which is a way of life. It's not just a capital R religion, but it's a lot deeper than that. You see? And this is what's going to permeate every aspect of that lifestyle that you engage in, that is Islam as a deen. These different buckets are going to fundamentally determine how it goes. When you think about the hadith before this, that talks to us about ahkam, right? We said this 2 weeks ago. Every act has a hukam to it. The idea is to know the hukam, the ruling before you do the act, ideally, right? Now you're in a place where you have a hadith that says, how do you implement those actions, not in a vacuum, but to particular recipients of what it is that you are giving? So how does this go now to the divine? And we're going to talk about, what does nasiha mean to Allah? What does it mean to His book? What does it mean to the prophets? What does it mean to the of the people, right? The leaders. And what does it mean for the people who are like the everyday people, right? Everything is just categorized in this. You see what I'm saying? Does that make sense? Okay, let's take a pause here. If you're going to stick around for the Ramadan class, we're going to start that at 7:30. We're going to be doing both on Mondays now for those who might not have been here last week. We're going to pray Isha in between. So people need to make wudu. What I'd like for you to do just for 1 minute before you get up, just turn to the person next to you. What do you take away from this hadith so far in terms of what we've discussed? Just so some of the ideas stay concrete. I don't want my voice to be the last voice you hear. So you can just talk to the people really quick next to you. What are you taking away? And then we'll call the adhan and pray Isha, and then we'll transition into the next class. But go ahead.
Yeah, I think it just gives us that.
Okay, so let's take a pause. We're going to pray Isha. People need to make wudu. We'll call the adhan, give people a few minutes for their sunnahs, and then we'll call the iqamah. And then after that, we'll start the Ramadan prep class. People want, there's still some food left from iftar. If you're hungry, feel free. The table is to the back, to the left of the room. But we'll pray in just a few minutes, inshallah. You call the adhan? Yeah, thanks, man.